to say something very important. I'm a legend here, in my own mind.
Do I just start? Does anyone know? Someone, I don't know.
Are you?
I'm ready to write it, yeah.
So I'm
thinking. Oh, okay.
So, when
you can say whatever you want to say, but whenever you're ready, I'm ready.
Oh, okay. Well, it was supposed to be at 9 o'clock, and it's a little after 9. Would you like me to start?
Please. Okay. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to ALI. This is, I forget which number of mine this has been, but everyone is a wonderful number to be at, and love them all. So this morning, I have the honor of introducing Rabbi Yitzhak Breitwitz. He was ordained by Mayor Israel in 1976. He's a graduate of John Hopkins University, Harvard Law School, J.D., 1979, magna cum laude. In addition to his rabbinical position, he was a tenured professor of law at the University of Maryland, specializing in contracts, commercial law, and medical ethics. After a distinguished career as a rabbi in Silver Spring, Maryland, and as a world-renowned lecturer and rabbinic authority, Rabbi Breitwitz made aliyah to Eretz Yisrael and his rav in Or Shemaya, Yerushalayim. He has published widely on Jewish law and ethics, and it's now my pleasure to introduce him.
Thank you so much. Yeah, maybe with a small crowd I can just talk from down here. It's a little easier, but let me sit down to make it even more relaxed. First, I was told by Rabbi Meir Levinger that I must be sure to also announce that my greatest teaching accomplishment is that I work for my Anot in Yerushalayim, so one needs to know that as well. Anyway, one of the difficulties of coming to a magnificent event like this is you really don't know where to go. In fact, if I didn't have to talk, I would actually have another choice for myself as well. So I do appreciate your coming. And in many, many ways, this is a session that I think somebody might have psychological resistance. Because, you know, when we talk about medical ethics, we're talking about very exciting issues, cloning, stem cell research, things that most of us are not going to encounter. But it's intellectually very, very fascinating. But it doesn't challenge us. It doesn't really say, I gotta change my life. Business ethics is a bit of a mundane field. The basic principles are not too hard to articulate. Be honest, be truthful, have a sense of obligation to others. Easily stated, very, very difficult to apply. And in many, many ways, it challenges us. You know, in one of the dictionaries, I think it was the Random House Dictionary. They took it out because there was public protest. But some of these dictionaries also have slang expressions. So if you looked up the word Jew, so Jew, member of religion, etc., but as a secondary slang meaning, Jew is a verb. To Jew somebody was a verb that was used in the South to mean to cheat somebody in business. And indeed, you know, the dictionary was not lying. There was such a slang usage in the South. Maybe there still is. But they took it out. You're not going to find it there now. But really, it's so unfortunate that, in fact, Jews have become known for driving hard deals, for a lack of business ethics. In many, many ways, we are a victim of our difficult history and our difficult circumstances. As you know, throughout most of the Middle Ages and into modern times, Jews were not allowed to own property. Real property. The only thing they could do was essentially banking, like the Rothschilds, and as a result they had to eke out a living under conditions of extreme persecution. So, as people who are scrapping for survival, we sometimes did learn how to drive hard deals, because otherwise we would die and there wouldn't be bread on the table. But in point of fact, one has to understand that the same Torah that says, keep Shabbat, keep Kashrut, keep Yom Kippur, also talks about business with integrity and with honesty. So when people ask me, how could an Orthodox Jew not be honest in business? My flippant answer is, if you're not honest in business, you're not an Orthodox Jew. To ask, how could an Orthodox Jew be dishonest in business, is asking, how can you be an Orthodox Jew and not keep Shabbos? Well, the answer is, you're obviously not. And we have to raise in our own consciousness that ethics in business is of equal importance, and perhaps even of greater importance. Let me give you an interesting visual analogy that makes this point. All of us know about the Ten Commandments, right? We have five and five. And one of the classic understandings is that the first five are the commandments between man and God. And the second five are the commandments between man and man, interpersonal, human relationships. Now, if you recall, the number of words and letters in the first five are much greater than the second five. The second five tend to be staccato, don't kill, don't steal, etc. And yet, we have a tradition that they cover the same amount of surface area. So obviously, if you have fewer letters covering the same surface area, the font must be larger. The letters must be larger. So when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai, now the first tablets, of course, were smashed, but let's say with the second tablets, and you're putting on your glasses to kind of read what do those things say, what are you going to see first? You're actually going to see the man-to-man commandments before you see the man-to-God commandments. They are actually larger in engraving. So that kind of shows you the primacy of those types of commandments. And again, it's a very unfortunate thing that when we talk about somebody as from religious, orthodox, we tend to focus almost entirely on Shabbos, Kashrus, Tefillin, and these are very important, don't get me wrong. Obviously, they're very, very important. But in fact, honesty in business is up there as well. In fact, the Talmud in Masechet Shabbat tells us that after we die, after 120 years, when we die, we go up to heaven, God is going to give us a final exam. Six questions. Prepare. And in his kindness, he's given us those questions ahead of time, so we could actually come up with the answers. Question number one is, did you conduct your business affairs with emunah, with integrity and with honesty? And that's really the subject of our talk. But just so you'll have the questions, let me just give you the rest of the other questions so you can think about them. Question number two, did you set aside regular times for the study of Torah? Question number three, did you try to have children? Did you occupy yourself in procreation? Question number four, did you eagerly yearn for the coming of Mashiach? Not just believe in Mashiach. Did you yearn for Mashiach? Question number five and six are a bit more abstract. Did you occupy yourself with wisdom? And question number six, were you a seeker of divine knowledge in terms of intimacy with God? But these are all very important questions. But the very fact that the very first question, even before Torah study is number two. Question number one is, did you conduct your business affairs with emunah? Now, I want to go back. I want to specifically use the Hebrew word because there are two translations. Nasasa v'nasata, which means, did you conduct your business with emunah? Now, emunah has two translations in this context, but I want you to see that both translations ultimately turn into the same meaning. One translation of emunah is honesty and integrity. Did you conduct your business affairs with honesty and integrity? Translation number two is, did you conduct your business affairs with belief in the Almighty, faith? Now, two different translations, but I hope you can see the correlation here. Because if you believe that the success of your endeavors comes from God's blessing, then it's impossible for you to think that you're going to come out ahead by going against God. If you think you're an independent actor, okay, crime does pay sometimes. But if you have faith that your parnassah, your sustenance, comes from God, then how can you possibly be successful if you go against God? Now, you may ask me, well, wait a second. I'm just being unrealistic. There are plenty of cheaters who seem to be very successful in the world. So how can I make the claim that you can't be successful if you go against God? Well, the answer once again is that God does take a longer view of things. And eventually, you know, the Madoffs of the world might be successful for quite a long time, but things eventually collapse. And if not in his lifetime, in this case it was in his lifetime, but you know, sometimes the next generation and the like. That which is built on lies and fraud, dishonesty, is ultimately not going to last. Yes, sir.
There's a saying about Ganava cum bachtalta, Brahmana Karya.
Yes.
You all disconnect.
Well, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, just to translate for people who may not be familiar with the expression, it's actually a very beautiful saying. It says that even the ganav, even the thief, will turn to God and ask God to bless him with success in his mission. And although that's touching in a way, because that shows that every Jew wants to believe in God, but in a sense, our general understanding is God does not help. The ganav's prayer is misdirected. He should pray for tshuva instead of saying, let me be successful in my endeavors. So this is the idea of the idea of importance of honesty in business, the very first question. And let's take another source, which is now from the Chumash itself instead of the Gemara. We say a religious Jew says the Shema, right? Everyone knows the famous paragraph of the Shema. And in the Shema it says, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your might. Three expressions, and each expression has a unique interpretation. With all of your heart, that means I pledge my emotions to God's service. All of your soul, even if I must give up my life. Now normally, of course, the Torah says saving a life overrides most of the commandments. But in the case of idolatry or sexual offenses or murder, you must be willing to die. If you remember when Rabbi Akiva was being murdered, his flesh was being flayed with iron combs, and his students were crying and his students were saying, why should you suffer this way? And Rabbi Akiva's response was, all my life I was hoping, when would I have the opportunity of serving God with all of my soul? And now I have this chance. Okay, all of that is great. But what is the expression, all of your might? Serve God with all of your might. So Rashi brings an interpretation to serve God with all of your money. And then Rashi raises the obvious question. That's superfluous. If I have to be willing to give my life for God, then of course I'll have to give up my money for God. What is the need to say, give up all your money? Rashi's answer, not necessarily. There are some people whose money is more valuable to them than their lives. Now, that may sound a little facetious. The older folk might remember a very, very classic Jack Benny. This is before television. This is Jack Benny on the radio still. And Jack Benny had a persona of being a very stingy person, although he actually was a generous person in real life. And the story goes that he's held up by a mugger in Central Park, your money or your life. And there is a 30-second pause in radio. Now that is an infinity. You think that, you know, the show is off the air. And he says, I'm thinking about it. Now that was Jack Benny. But in truth, there are people who commit suicide, so their families will get life insurance. Think about It's a Wonderful Life. Remember Jimmy Stewart and the like. There are people who are workaholics, who are really giving up their lives in order to make more money when they see their kids, you know, 5 minutes a week or whatever it is. So what does it mean, though, to serve God with all of your money? So the significance is, I would suggest a different answer than Rashi's answer. I would say that it might be harder to serve God with all of your money. Why is that so? Because as great as martyrdom is, it's that 1 second of self-sacrifice. I jump into the fire. Now that's a tremendous, tremendous thing. But it's going to be over pretty soon. But the struggle to live an economic life of integrity, that is day to day to day, minute by minute, every time you have to make a decision. And that is something that's lifelong. And it's easier to die as a Jew than it is to live as a Jew. So b'chol mo'odecha, to serve God with monetary and financial integrity, is really quite a magnificent accomplishment. Now, I would say that the core principles of ethical behavior in this area are really threefold, and then we'll try to flesh it out with specific examples within the halachic construct. And that is, number one, halacha espouses an ethic of responsibility and obligation rather than right and privilege. You know, particularly in the United States, we tend to look at life through the prism of rights. What is owed to me? That's why there are so many lawyers in the United States, to vindicate my rights. What are my rights? This is not a new phenomenon. From the very beginning of the American Republic, many of you may have heard of the famous work, Democracy in America, by Alexander de Tocqueville, if that's how you pronounce it, one of the very, very famous books, which is describing the United States from the very, very beginning. He talked about the fact that there always was a culture of rugged individualism in America that basically said, if your fence is 1/16th of an inch over my boundary, I'm going to take you to court and have you remove that fence. That's why there are so many court shows on television, whether it's People's Court, and now there are a million others as well, because everybody, you know, got to go to court over this and that. Now, Baruch Hashem, I'm much happier they're going to court than simply shooting each other, which they sometimes do as well. But we do live in a culture in which every person has claims of victimhood and are trying to assert rights. In fact, there was even a discussion, you know, we have what are called protected classes, like, you know, normally it's race or now it's sexual orientation. There was even a movement that lawyers were so widely despised that lawyers ought to be classified as special groups to be protected under hate crime legislation and the like. So the typical American philosophy is I wake up in the morning, I look in the mirror, and I ask myself, what does the world owe me today? What claims do I have against the world? Judaism speaks from a radically different perspective. You know, in Judaism, in classical Hebrew, modern Hebrew is a little different because modern Hebrew is westernized. But in classical Hebrew, there is no word for rights. There are only words for obligations. Now, this may sound semantic, but it's very, very interesting. Judaism does not say, let's say I lend you money. Judaism does not say, I have a right to collect my debt. Judaism expresses it, you have an obligation to pay me. Meaning everything is expressed in terms of obligation, not in terms of right. Now in modern Hebrew, interestingly enough, we do have a word called zechuyot, which does mean rights, but that is really just a Hebrew term of a Western expression. In classical rabbinic literature and halachic literature, everything is expressed as chayav, obligation. Now, you may say I'm nitpicking, and you may say that's semantic, because obviously, if you have an obligation to pay, I have a right to collect. Every obligation presupposes a right. But by expressing things in terms of obligations rather than rights, that reminds every person that in the morning, I have to ask myself, what can I give to the world today? Not what can I take. My orientation is my responsibility, my obligation, not my privileges. That's a very, very important orientation. And that is the opposite of what de Tocqueville described. The Talmud has a story at the end of the sixth parak in Bava Metzia, that a certain person had hired workers to transport a barrel of wine. And they were negligent and careless, and the wine broke. The barrel broke, and the wine was lost. So he took the workers to court, to Beit Din, to recover for the value of the barrel and the wine. And the workers had no defense. Their only defense was, hey, you know, we're poor, we really can't afford this. We did the best that we can. So the judge says, you don't have to pay. So the person said to the judge, actually it was his rabbi, a judge is not allowed to do this, but this is a rabbi-disciple relationship. Is that the law? They don't have to pay me? And the rabbi said, for you, that's the law. You don't squeeze people beyond their ability to pay. Okay, so he accepts that. But act two is they turn around and say, hey, wait a minute, you didn't pay us our wages today. Now this is really a classic example of chutzpah. You know, the old definition of chutzpah is the person who kills his parents, and then when he's tried for murder, seeks mercy from the court because now they're an orphan. By the way, that's an old Yiddish joke, but the truth of the matter is that that defense was actually raised in California a few years ago. So truth becomes, fiction becomes truth. But anyway, they sued for their wages. And the rabbi said, pay their wages. Is that the law? For you, that's the law. Now, the commentaries tell us we're not talking about a regular judge. A regular court would not be allowed to do that. A regular court has to follow the law. But because this was the person's Rebbe, the person's teacher, the Rebbe is telling a person, don't go through life seeking to vindicate rights. Yes, you have a right to do things, but learn to forgive. Learn to look at what are your responsibilities in the world instead of what the world owes you. And in that way, you actually become a happier person because you're not so concerned with, and in fact, this goes beyond the financial. This refers to slights and insults and all sorts of disagreements. We're approaching, it's not our topic per se, but we're approaching the month of Elul and the Rosh Hashanah, where we think about repentance and making amends and changing. And we're filled with so many grievances, and the grievances come from senses of entitlement that we have. And again, I'm talking to myself. I don't mean at all to give musar to anybody. But we're filled with entitlements, what the world owes me, what they owe me, what he owes me, what she owes me. I wasn't treated with respect. If we can put it aside and just wake up every morning and ask ourselves, easier said than done, and I admit that, what are my responsibilities today? What does God want me to do? I would be a happier person. I would have a focus in my life. I would know that even if things come down the pike that aren't so pleasing to me, I don't let it bother me. I don't let it affect me, because I still have a sense of what I need to do and where I go. So that is the first prong that I would call the ethics of responsibility and obligation rather than right and privilege. The second, of course, is connected, and that is the ethics of compassion. To understand, try to understand that most people are not Adolf Hitlers, Yimach Shmo, that most people are not monsters, most people are in a decent level of decency, even if they've wronged me, and if people behave in bad ways, I try to understand and I try to forgive. Now that doesn't mean I necessarily have to be a dish rag, but I don't push people beyond where they're able to go at a given standpoint. And pillar number three is, of course, the pillar of honesty, integrity, and truth. Now, it's very, very interesting. The Hebrew word for truth is called emes, or emet, depending on your Israeli or not. And the Hebrew word for lying is sheker. And the Talmud has a very fascinating observation regarding emet and sheker. And here I hope you can visualize the Hebrew letters. Every Hebrew letter in emet has a firm foundation. The Aleph has two legs that it's standing on. The Mem has a wide base. And the Tuf has two legs. Every letter of Sheker is a very flimsy. The Shin, now although in a printed Shin that has a base, but if you look at the Shin in the Sefer Torah, the three heads of the Shin come to a point. So it's a point. It's like balancing on a point. The Kuf is also one leg. The whole weight of the letter is on one leg. And a resh is one leg. And the Talmud says, truth stands firmly. Lying, fraud, is very, very shaky. It doesn't have a permanence. You can get away with things for a while, but they catch up. And of course, anyone that's been a parent and has encountered children trying to make up stories, and indeed probably we remember when we were children and we did the same thing, knows that eventually, you try to change this story and that story and that story and that story, but it all accumulates and it all falls down and it all collapses. So the three pillars here are the ethics of responsibility, the ethics of compassion, and the ethics of truth and honesty. And here I have to say that although all of us, including myself, engage in the occasional white lies, but unfortunately one has to realize that our children take in everything. So for example, things that seem minor and insignificant may lay the foundation for serious lying behaviors later. So for example, somebody calls my house and I don't want to talk to them. Either they bother me too much or whatever it would be, or I want to avoid the conversation. My son answers the phone. Says, can I talk to your father? Son gives me the message, so-and-so Nudnik wants to talk to you. So I might be tempted to say, you know, just tell him I'm not home. Okay. Child communicates the message. Fast forward 6 months later, you get a call from the principal that your child cheated on his test. You come in and say, how can you cheat? How can you do that? How can you lie? And he says, well, Abba, you lied when that person called up. Well, you're going to, well, that's different. Hmm? Why is it different? Well, that's, you know, that's the way it is. When you're grown up, you can do these things. You know, the point basically is, the whole idea of raising children based on the idea, do as I say, not as I do, is going to be a recipe for absolute failure. Because children see it all, and they know it all, and they sense it all. And there's a little poem that says, those little eyes are watching. And unfortunately, perhaps, that is very, very, very true. And we have to live lives where we don't have to be ashamed if somebody is watching what we're doing. The Gemara quotes a great rabbi who lived a long time. And he was asked, why did he merit a long life? And his answer is, I never said anything that I had to look around and see who was listening. Everything I said was something I was not ashamed of, based on that, in that way. Okay. I also want to make another point, too, that although, you know, Judaism does place a great, great emphasis. I'm sorry, did you want to have a comment?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I don't know. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Lucky you're not at an auction. We would have taken the bid there. Yeah. Judaism places a great amount of value, of course, on deep intellectual, subtle analysis, right? Talmudic study is a very good example where we analyze and sub-analyze and go through. But here I would like to suggest that when it comes to honesty in business, you're supposed to be a simple person, not a complex person. By that I mean to say the following. If you go through Talmudic discussions, you will sometimes find distinctions between the way we treat Jews and the way we treat non-Jews. And we go over the different subtleties. But operationally, there shouldn't be any difference. And that is for a very, very simple reason. Most of the laws that apply to theft and dishonesty and misrepresentation absolutely apply to Jews and non-Jews equally, number one. Number two, vis-a-vis non-Jews, there may be a catastrophic aspect called desecrating God's name, which the whole Torah may come into disrepute. And number three, and this is a very important point, morality is not a divisible phenomenon. By that I mean, you can't be a person that is immoral to some people and moral to others. Meaning, by definition, the immorality you will exhibit to some people is going to pour over into other people. This is a medrash. This is a Maimer Chazal. The rabbis say in the medrash, Tana Deve Eliyahu, one of the great medrashim, which is actually revelations from Eliyahu Hanavi himself. It might even be higher than many other medrashim. He who is dishonest to the Gentile, he who cheats the goy, will cheat the Jew. He who murders the guy will murder the Jew. And as a result, therefore, all of the different subtle distinctions that people sometimes make, one needs not to be that subtle. One needs to be honest, one needs to be open, and the like. Now, let me just mention this. I want to mention a few areas. First of all, halacha is very, very unique in that halacha contains obligations even towards my competitors. Now, it's very interesting. If we were to ask, in a capitalist system, what are my obligations towards competitors, the short answer is generally nothing, because capitalism is based on a Darwinian model, it's called social Darwinism, actually, of survival of the fittest, meaning to say, if I can do something better than you, then you ought to be driven out of business. In fact, that is why a pure capitalist is against bailouts for auto companies and everything else, because if you can't make it, then you ought to fail and let something better come. Now, broadly speaking, and this is a complicated topic in and of itself, halacha more or less endorses the notion of competition and free enterprise. Halacha is not a socialist state, although the early state of Israel, and still even today, was socialist, but that was not because of halachic reasons. But halacha recognizes that you do have certain duties towards your competitors. And let me give you one example. The Talmud talks about the idea that if you have, you open up a candy store, and I want to open up a candy store, that's perfectly legitimate, I'm allowed to compete with you. But consider this example. Let's say there's a dead-end street, so traffic can only come to the store from one direction. And store number one is around halfway in, and I want to place my store towards the beginning of the street, so anybody who would be coming to your store would have to go past my store. According to halacha, that is an unfair competition. If the street is open on both ends, so I'll get the people coming from there, and you'll get the people coming from there, but in a situation where inevitably people will pass your store before they pass my store, halacha considered that to be an unfair competition, and when there is a Sanhedrin or a Beit Din, they would be able to enjoin that. Or another example might be considered predatory pricing. Now, we understand that in the age of Walmarts and the like, a lot of ma-and-pa stores do get driven out of business simply because the huge stores like Walmart have what are called economies of scale. They can buy things much, much cheaper. And that is indeed legitimate, meaning nobody's going to, I mean, again, Walton never called me up for a shiloh, but even if somehow this would go to a rabbinical court, a big store has the right to open up a business. But consider the following. What big stores sometimes do is they actually sell items temporarily at a loss. At a loss, they sell items below their cost because they can make it up by raising the price in other stores till they drive a business out of business, and then they can raise prices because they're the only store in town. Now, selling below cost as a temporary strategy to force a business closure is considered to be an unfair practice. It's one thing if you're more efficient, if you're more productive, if you're able to make your product at a lower cost, that's for the benefit of the consumer. But to engage in what is called a predatory price structure with the intention of making it up by overcharges in other products and in other stores with the sole intention of driving out this competitor, that is an unfair business. Another example would be promotional efforts that are targeted specifically to a discrete clientele. The example would be that this wouldn't apply to a general retail business, but it might apply to professional services. Let's say I'm opening up a competing medical office, a competing law office, a competing accounting office. And instead of just offering my services to the general public, I offer specific deals to your clientele to take them away from you. In a sense, that's unfair because although clients are certainly free to go and shop around for whatever is best for them, but they should not be specifically targeted by a competitor. Now, this raises some interesting halachic questions. Who owns the client? I mean, I'll give you an example from law, which is the area I'm most familiar with, but it would apply equally true with medicine. Let's say that you have a lawyer in a law firm. And he's part of a law firm. He may be a partner in the law firm, or he may just be a salaried associate in the law firm. But he's been handling clients on behalf of this law firm for 5 or 6 years. He now decides to go off on his own. Is he halachically permitted to speak to his clients and urge them to go with him? Now, I already said it is wrong to target someone else's clientele. But the question is, who defines whose clientele this is? From a technical standpoint, these clients were clients of the law firm. But from a practical standpoint, I was the one that did the work for them. I was the one that had the personal relationship. Are they my clients? In which case, I am free to take them. Or are they clients of the firm?
You didn't have the financial.
Yes, that's very true. That is very true. So these raise ethical questions. Now again, don't get me wrong. There is absolutely nothing wrong with my informing my clients that I'm leaving the firm. But the question is to give them sweetheart deals, to give them inducements, to give them specific encouragements. that would be ethically, and I mean halachically, problematical in terms of you're taking away a benefit that's already been connected to a given business. So the concept that I have certain responsibilities towards my competitors, that makes a lot of sense. For the same reason, halacha would accept the concept, which is very common in business, of limited time non-competition clauses. In many, many businesses, you might be enjoined, you might be prohibited by contract from starting, you know, if I leave a firm, from starting a competing business within a certain number amount of time. Even a restaurant, right? If I leave McDonald's, I might not be allowed to start a hamburger place for 3 years within a geographical radius of 5 miles or 10 miles or whatever. Halacha would understand that there is a concept of not reaching out to somebody's customers. Again, I'm not here to give you definitive answers to all of these questions. But there's an old saying in Judaism that the question of a wise person is half an answer, meaning the very fact that these are questions. I want to raise your consciousness that this is not simply a matter of do what you want to do. Ethical problems are halachic problems. And if one is a religious and committed Jew, you try to figure out what does the Torah want me to do in this case, which means ultimately what does God want me to do? And if one cannot learn these sources on their own, and by the way, there's some very excellent books in English on business ethics and the like, one needs to understand that halacha is not only about Shabbos, Kashrus, and the holidays, and the synagogue service. Halacha is about how do you leave a business, what can you do vis-a-vis the clients of your former employer, when and how are you allowed to compete, what are your responsibilities. These are halachic matters, and a religious Jew needs to find out what does halacha say about these matters. Now,
employees, right?
Say, I didn't hear you.
For employees also.
Yes. That's correct. That's correct. Robbing and right. Headhunting is certainly a problem. Now, again, the employee is free to contact the headhunter, so to speak, but the headhunter should be less open to invading existing employment relationships. Now, let me mention something else. One of the laws in the Torah that's, Baruch Hashem, has become much better known, but still widely violated, is a whole category called Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara basically says, you're not allowed to say negative, derogatory things about other people, even if it's true. You know, they say that Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, Alice Roosevelt Longworth, she married Nicholas Longworth, who was also a famous Speaker of the House. So she became quite a great socialite in Washington. So towards the end of her life, when she was not able to move, she had a very nice embroidered pillow on her couch next to her that said, "If you can't say something nice, come sit next to me." Kind of inviting people to kind of gossip. Again, you know, I don't know if it was true in her case, it was just a joke and the like. But again? Is that Lashon Hara? That's right. But we know there is a law of Lashon Hara, and that creates some very, very interesting issues about advertising campaigns, political campaigns. On the way here, I heard one of Donald Trump's press conferences, and all it is saying how bad the other person. Jeb is an idiot, and Hillary is a liar. Yes, it's Phil. Political campaigns, product disparagement, competitor disparagement. Are we dealing with very serious laws of Lashon Hara? And how do you deal with that? Can a Jewish person be a copywriter? Can a Jewish person be a reporter? Now, when I was growing up, many, many years ago, it was very interesting. There was actually a strategy in advertising that you never mentioned the competitor, even negatively, because that would implant the competitor's name in your mind. So I remember when they used to compare laundry detergents. They would have, you know, Dash or whatever it is, and then they would have all of these brands covered with a brown paper bag, brown X, Y, Z. Now, you're watching a commercial, unless you're paying attention, you don't even know, is it Coke? What is this commercial about? There's Coke and there's Pepsi and all of these different brands are hitting you and the like. So let me just mention again, Lashon Hara is a vast, vast topic, but let me just mention the following important guidelines. Judaism is very unique, that we actually have a classic, major, major work of halakhic literature that is devoted entirely to the subject of permissible and impermissible gossip. And this, of course, is the immortal work of the Chafetz Chaim. In fact, the Chafetz Chaim's name was Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen. He died in 1933. There are still a few people alive who remember the Chafetz Chaim. He called his work Chafetz Chaim because Chafetz Chaim means he who desires life, and it's based on a verse in Psalms. Who is the person who desires life? Let him guard his tongue from evil. And he wrote the book anonymously because he did not want to reveal his identity. Eventually he became known. And there are many, many stories. He became kind of a folk hero to the Jewish people. So many stories about his righteousness. In fact, I'll give you two stories just to give you a sense of the man. He made a living by selling the books that he wrote anonymously. He didn't identify himself as the author. So once he's on a train, and a man sits next to him, a man sees all these books, and a man says, "Wow, the books of the Chafetz Chaim, what a scholar, what a rabbi, what a tzaddik, amazing person." Chafetz Chaim says, "Well, I know the guy, he's not that special." Nobody. So the man was so incensed that he's insulting the great rabbi, he slapped him in the face. He says, "How dare you talk about that man?" Anyway, when they get to Warsaw, apparently there was a little bit of a group that knew the Chafetz Chaim, and they're welcoming him to Warsaw. So the man gets a little nervous. Who did I hit in the train there? I mean, he seems to be a bit of a famous person. So he just nudges somebody and he says, "Can you just tell me who that man is over there?" Says, "You don't know. That's the Chafetz Chaim, the author of the Chafetz Chaim." So now the person feels really, really bad. I mean, he slapped the Chafetz Chaim that he respected so much. So he goes over to the Chafetz Chaim and he says, "Please forgive me. I didn't know who you were. I wouldn't have hit you if I knew you were the Chafetz Chaim. I hit you because I thought you were not respectful to the Chafetz Chaim." So the Chafetz Chaim says, "Don't worry. I'm very grateful to you. All of my life I taught you're not allowed to say bad things about other people. But you taught me I shouldn't say bad things about myself either. I spoke Lashon Hara about me. I deserve to be hit." There's something profound in that bit of folk wisdom. Because basically, sometimes the reason we disparage others is because we have a low self-image of ourselves. If we look at ourselves in a healthy way, we feel less of a need to put down other people. The other famous story, there are many, many, you can give you hundreds of stories, but another famous story is that once one of his students was arrested for smuggling. This is in Tsarist Russia. This was very, very serious. This could be a death penalty or life in Siberia, which would have been the equivalent of a death sentence. And the Chafetz Chaim came to testify as a character witness. And, through an interpreter. Chafetz Chaim did not speak Russian, but he spoke Yiddish, but there would be an interpreter. But in order to be a witness, you had to swear on a Christian Bible. And the Chafetz Chaim would refuse to do that. So the lawyer says to the judge, "Judge, this is a man that's not corruptible. He never lies. He doesn't have to swear. I'll tell you a story about how honest the Chafetz Chaim is and how he cannot be affected by money. This rabbi was once walking in the street and a pickpocket took his wallet. And the Chafetz Chaim ran after the person saying, 'I forgive you, I forgive you, I forgive you,' because he didn't want the person to be guilty of the sin of theft." So he says to the judge, "Judge, such a man cannot be bribed with money. Such a man is incorruptible. Such a man is totally honest." So the judge looks at the lawyer and says, "Do you expect me to believe that story?" The lawyer says, "You know, Your Honor, I don't believe it either. But the one thing I can tell you is they don't tell the stories about you and me." Meaning the fact that even if a story is not true, by the way, this is true for a lot of Hasidic stories too, even if it's not true, it shows you something about the character and the nature of the person that it could be true. They said by the golem as well, whether the Maharal made a golem or not is historically a very, very serious question. But whether he did or didn't, he could have had he wanted to. And therefore that's kind of enough for us to know the power of the tzaddik. So in the Chafetz Chaim, he deals with a very important question, which has implications for business and many other areas. And that is, you know, on one hand, Lashon Hara's message generally is keep your mouth shut, don't say bad things about people. On the other hand, the Chafetz Chaim points out, sometimes, not only are you permitted to say negative things, sometimes you are commanded to say negative things. You must give people the information that will prevent them from suffering physical, emotional, financial loss. And for you to be a tzaddik and not speak up when you have information that could spare a person serious detriment would not be a mitzvah. It would be a sin. Remember, Leviticus 19 says, Lo tamod al dam reyecha, you cannot stand by idly. Now we'll give you some simple extreme examples. Let's assume I know that a child molester is applying for a teaching position. Now today, of course, this information is generally very quickly ascertainable, but let's assume that the school doesn't know. I know. Is any sane person going to say, well, it's lashon hara for me, I'm saying something bad about the guy? No, it's necessary to protect children. Shiduchim. Sarah is engaged to a guy who I know hit or slapped his prior wife. Right? You gotta tell. Shmerel is going to enter a business partnership with Beryl, and Beryl has been engaged in embezzlement or bankruptcies because of negligence. I don't mean bankruptcy per se is a bad mark, but because of mismanagement of business. In other words, do you see the point here? The point basically here is, on one hand, we do have this concept of lashon hara, which is extremely important. On the other hand, when it's necessary to protect people from serious detriment, it becomes a mitzvah. Now, how to balance that? The Chafetz Chaim has all sorts of guidelines. You can't exaggerate. If you know something secondhand, you must say it's only secondhand. If you only know one or two negative incidents, you must say, I only know one or two. You cannot overgeneralize. There are all sorts of rules here. But this would be the key. So if I'm an auto mechanic, and you told me that this was serviced by a prior, by somebody else, and I know that that person does shoddy work, you know, I shouldn't necessarily say he's a shyster, he's dishonest, he's a thief. I shouldn't necessarily use descriptive terms, labels, because labels, you know, might be exaggerating things. But factually, if he's giving you a car that might be dangerous or might break down, it is absolutely not lashon hara for me to give you that information. Now, the Chafetz Chaim does say there is a condition here. The condition is that your motive not be to cause loss to the other person. Only God knows that. Your motive is to protect this person from harm. But the point is, lashon hara is not an excuse to allow people to be hurt. And the same thing we do with for political campaigns. It's perfectly legitimate to criticize and expose the errors in decisions that were made politically, because that is necessary for the public to be able to evaluate. So if I'm a journalist and I'm writing political exposés of corruption, that is not lashon hara, because that is giving the public the information that it needs to be able to evaluate who should represent it and who should make decisions. On the other hand, you get into an interesting question. I wrote an article a number of years ago when Bill Clinton was still president about Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. And the Monica Lewinsky scandal involved, Clinton's personal life. Now, this is an interesting question. Is it lashon hara to write about the personal moral shortcomings of political candidates? Now again, to write about their governmental decisions is 1,000% legitimate, and it's something the public needs to know. What about their personal life? Again, halachically, the way we would analyze it is this. If the only value of the information is sensationalistic and voyeuristic, it is lashon hara. If, however, this is relevant to ascertaining the fitness of a person for the office to which they seek, then it would not be lashon hara. We could debate this. We can debate whether personal character is relevant to political fitness. It's a very, very fascinating question.
But in so doing, you're writing lashon hara about Monica Lewinsky.
Say again?
In so doing, you're offering lashon hara about Monica Lewinsky.
Yes, yes. Well, the reason why I, if you ask me why I was allowed to write the article, there is a concept that once something is in the public domain, even if it shouldn't have been there, in other words, it's not Lashon Hara for me to write about something that's already in the papers. So I had my heter. I didn't break the story. But the issue would be the people who break the story. And this is a fascinating question. And again, this takes me far afield. This is yet another topic, but that's going to be the issue of political versus personal morality and the impact. Yeah.
Yeah, but to fan on this comment, you are not the first to write about the other person.
Yeah.
Because Gene already is in the public
yes.
domain.
Yes.
However, what you're doing possibly is piling on, and that itself may be a problem. But I want to also add to a previous note that in there, you know, in the example of like the auto mechanic, this guy is no good, blah blah blah. It's a different tack to that is to criticize the work.
Yeah.
The work that was done on this car, the work that associated is substandard.
Yeah.
It was a problem with the work. Whoever did that,
yeah.
whoever worked on the car, is no good for
right.
this reason.
Right, yeah.
But,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you want to address both points.
No, yeah, well, you're correct. I do agree with you. In terms of your first point, that piling on is a compounding of Lashon Hara. I agree with you. However, in an article like I was writing, I was not piling on any accusations. I was addressing a theoretical question, and that is, does personal immorality impact on suitability for political office? And the fact that, incidentally, I was referring to that incident... that was in the public domain, and I don't think any gasoline was being added. But I do agree with you, there is a concept of adding gasoline to a fire that could very well be true. In terms of the second point, again, I agree with you 100%, and that is, if the dispensation for revealing this is to protect a person from suffering the consequences of bad work, and in the case of a car, of course, potentially dangerous work, then yeah, instead of let the person draw his own conclusions regarding the mechanic, and you focus on the work. You're simply grading the work, and the person then has the information he needs to make his decision. Maybe he'll still go with the cheaper person for whatever reason. Yeah?
I'm sorry, can you address the concept of the conflict with American law in terms of insider trading? Like what Martha Stewart case...
Yeah.
Where she was informed by, what's his name, Wachtel, I think was his name, about the impending financial disaster that might occur, a merger to sell her stock.
Yeah. Insider trading is a very, very interesting idea. Let me just say, as a general rule, of course, halacha, as secular law does prohibit anything which is a fraudulent misrepresentation. But halacha does go further. Halacha has never embraced the notion of caveat emptor. For example, in a sale of a car, sale of a house, sale of whatever it is, I have a halachic obligation, if I'm the seller, to disclose any defects that exist in the merchandise that I'm selling, and failure to disclose would be tantamount to fraud. Now, in many parts of modern law, law has moved in that direction, but it started off with the caveat emptor orientation. Halacha does reject that. Based on that idea, for me to trade, to buy or sell, based on informational advantage that is not possessed and is not possessable by anybody else outside of the particular intimate relationship would seem to be fraud by non-disclosure. And as a result, again, halacha does not criminalize this. Let me point out that halacha's remedies for fraud are totally civil. They involve restitution, rescission, cancellation, and the like. So we're not talking about jail sentences. But I think overall halacha would prohibit trading on the basis of inside information. And this would fall under the halachic category of mekach ta'ut, which basically means transactions that are consummated by mistake. And transactions consummated by a mistake through non-disclosure are considered to be voidable. So that's how I think we would approach it. Yeah.
I encountered a situation a number of years ago. I wonder if you comment on. I was in the shidduch market, second marriage, no longer a youngster, and I would meet women who would misrepresent their age.
Yes.
Say they were younger than they were. And when the first time this came to my knowledge, I asked about this, dumbfounded to hear that Great Buskin had given their Hector that women could do this because of the so-called shit-up crisis. I was dumbfounded. I could not believe it. Can you comment? Maybe I'm off.
Well, I also... I'm also very, very shocked and surprised. I'm aware of this, and I'm equally shocked when I heard that it was done. What I would say is this, though. I would say that an initial deception in order to meet somebody might be justifiable simply because it'll give them a chance to show their good points. On the other hand, at some point, there has to be full disclosure. We have a similar problem, not so much with age, but with disease or psychiatric history. Sometimes people have medical issues, they have psychiatric issues, and if they simply are totally upfront before they meet the person, no one's ever going to see them. And I don't want to go out with a problem. On the other hand, if somebody would have a chance to see their good points, they could then make a decision weighing good and bad. So it is common that we often tell people that have serious medical problems that you must absolutely disclose this, but do it after 3 dates. So the person would be able to see the good part of you and then make a decision. But even that is different than that, because that's not lying. That's simply omission, which might not be the same. You're actually talking about lying, so I am a little disturbed with that. I don't think it's proper to lie. The seal of God is truth, and God is a God of truth.
What is your conclusion?
Well, as is always the case with the Jewish matters, there are two questions. But I think that... personal morality and fidelity to a marital bond, I think, is relevant regarding the moral qualities of leadership. That's correct. And I think morality is not so easily divisible, but it is an open question. Okay. Now, and this is different, though, than a football player. It's very interesting. So it may not be Lashon Hara for me to report on what Clinton does, but it may be Lashon Hara for me to report on what some football player does, because after all, that has nothing to do with how he plays football. It's very interesting. The football player may be more entitled to his privacy than the President of the United States. Okay, we're almost finished. There's so much to talk about. Let me just mention, though, a few very, very important areas which are technical, but one needs to be aware of these. Jews are supposed to take their disputes to rabbinical courts and not to secular courts. If I want to sue you for a breach of contract, even if the standards are going to be secular law, because the contract is a secular contract, according to halacha, I am not allowed to take you to court unless you refuse to go to a Beit Din. In other words, Jews are supposed to go to Beit Dins. How do you find your Beit Din? That's also a bit of a problem, but most major cities, metropolitan areas, do have Jewish organizations of Beit Din. And there are two types of Beit Din. Some have a permanent Beit Din, meaning there actually are a panel of three rabbis who serve as judges. The other type of Beit Din is called a Zabla Beit Din, Z-A-B-L-A. It sounds like some type of South American dance. But Zabla is an abbreviation where it's really an arbitration panel. Each side chooses. I choose my rabbi, you choose your rabbi, and the two rabbis choose a third rabbi. That is called a Zabla Beit Din. If you refuse, then I could go to secular court. But that's a very, very important idea, that Jews are supposed to resolve their disputes by Beit Din. And I will tell you, in Baltimore, and in Washington as well, but in Baltimore has a bigger Beit Din, all sorts of cases go to the Baltimore Beit Din, commercial cases involving sometimes millions of dollars. And the way this works is the following. Legally, it's very, very interesting. When parties go to a Beit Din, they are asked to sign a binding arbitration agreement ahead of time. Now, what that means is that the Beit Din decision now becomes a legally enforceable arbitration. So if the Beit Din said, you have to pay me money, and you refused, I can now go to a secular court, I can have the arbitration award confirmed, that's what it's called, and it then becomes civilly enforceable as a judgment. So arbitration can work for all of these things. The only area where it doesn't work is for child custody and child support. And that's very interesting. Technically, even child custody should go to a Beit Din. But the only problem is, and two religious Jews should submit to a Beit Din, the issue of child visitation in the case of a divorce. But practically, there is no way to make it legally enforceable, because even if the parties signed a binding arbitration agreement, the state judicial system will always revisit what is in the best interest of the children. So unfortunately, if somebody reneges on their Beit Din commitments, there is nothing legally that can be done. But that still doesn't take away the religious principle. Yeah.
I understand that the Beit Din determines a financial settlement in the child custody situation, the child support.
Religiously, that should be so.
And
yeah.
If it's less than what the state would determine to be appropriate, then it's not legitimate.
Well, let me point out. See, there's a semantic problem here. Not legitimate means it is not legally legitimate. But the fact that it's not legally legitimate does not mean it is religiously illegitimate. Meaning to say, religiously, I am supposed to listen to the Beit Din, even if it is different than the secular. But if I don't do that, then I can get away with it.
So would a Beit Din be inclined to create a financial settlement less than a
usually not, because they know that there's no way to enforce it. Beit Dins will not do things that are worthless, and since they know there's no way that they can hold the person to it, they're not going to bother. Okay, I think we have to stop here, but again, there's a lot more to talk about, and I hope, if nothing else, this at least raises the consciousness that one needs to think about business matters just as one thinks about all other halachic matters. Thank you. We'll see you later.